Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes, intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
Today, we have Dr. Zara Cooper, an acute care surgeon and trauma surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital. She's going to be talking to us about her article that was recently published in the Annals of Surgery titled, Recommendations for Best Communication Practices to Facilitate Goal Concordant Care for Seriously Ill Older Patients with Emergency Surgical Conditions. It's a mouthful, but it is a great topic on how to discuss difficult topics in palliative care with patients in the extremists of life. And she really gives us great insight to this. So you guys, I hope you are looking forward to this as we are.
So welcome to another episode of Behind the Knife. We're very pleased to have Zara Cooper with us, who's an associate surgeon in the Division of Trauma, Burns, and Surgical Critical Care at Brigham Women's Hospital. She's also an assistant professor of surgery at Harvard Medical School. Zara, welcome to Behind the Knife.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me on.
You know, we always like to start out these things by having you give us a little bit about of your background, where you grew up, and how it came to the point where you wound up in Boston. So can you tell the listeners a little bit about you?
Sure. So I grew up in New York City, and I went to undergrad in Chicago at Northwestern University, and actually spent a few years in advertising before I decided to go back to medical school. And I did post-bac, and then I went to medical school back in New York at Mount Sinai, and then I went to Brigham Women's to do my surgical residency, and I also did my surgical critical care fellowship there. I spent a year in Seattle at Harborview doing my trauma fellowship, and then came back to the Brigham to join the faculty. So I ended up in Boston through my training, and also because my husband is here.
Obviously, I was there for a long time out on the West Coast, and those guys are out there right now. So you got to miss Seattle, right?
I do miss Seattle. I have a lot of respect for my friends who are out there, and it's an amazing, amazing.
So Dr. Cooper, your current research efforts are really focused on how to understand the surgical informed consent process. And how, care is delivered to critically ill surgical patients and in an effort to develop, tools to predict, which patients are going to have prolonged ICU stays after surgery in order to better optimize the preoperative advanced and end-of-life kind of goals of care. How did you get involved in palliative medicine as an acute care surgeon? How did you kind of find yourself in this world of palliative care?
So when I was doing my critical care training at Brigham, I did it after my third year of residency, and I was really overwhelmed by, the amount of end-of-life care that I found myself doing, and I felt ill-prepared to do it as a surgeon. I felt that a lot of what I saw as treatment that wasn't necessarily benefiting patients was happening because we were not communicating very well what our expectations were versus what patients' expectations for recovery would be. And so I became interested in actually the ethics literature first, and then that kind of led me to palliative care. And so when I came back as faculty at Brigham Women's, I had an opportunity to do a mini fellowship in hospice and palliative medicine at Dana-Farber, and then to take my palliative care board. So I took my hospice and palliative care boards in 2012. So I'm boarded in hospice and palliative medicine as well. And, as an acute care surgeon at a tertiary center, I, like so many others of us, deal with end-of-life issues all the time as a critical care physician in my surgical practice. And then also increasingly as a trauma surgeon, so much of our treatment now is geriatric focused. And so another area of my research is geriatric trauma and, just recognizing the impact of frailty and geriatric syndromes. And, we are seeing more and more older patients who are really near the end of life, and their fall, which is the reason for their trauma admissions, is really a sentinel event. So I don't actually practice hospice and palliative medicine outside of my surgery practice, but I find a lot of opportunity to do it within surgery.
How did this panel come about, the best communication practices for emergency surgery and, critically ill older patients? How did this, this all come about?
So I was fortunate enough to get what was called a SPARC grant from Ariadne Labs. And Ariadne Labs is a center for healthcare innovation run by Atul Gawande here in Boston. And the purpose of, or the mission of Ariadne is to really, find solutions for critical moments in people's lives. And one of those moments is end-of-life care. So he developed a serious illness care project, and I became the leader of the surgical aspect of that. And we were trying to develop a framework, a communication framework, to really help surgeons navigate this kind of treacherous terrain. And as a general surgeon, as a fellow general surgeon, Atul was very interested in kind of the preoperative setting, as was I. So we wanted to develop, as I said, a communication framework. And, you know, there's a process for that. If you read the checklist manifesto, there's a process for it. And part of it is to do this extensive background document, which we did and was published in Annals probably about a year and a half ago, which is called Pitfalls of Communication, Communication that Leads to Non-Beneficial Treatment. And then the second step in that process is to really create an advisory panel to look at, you know, all the critical aspects of what a framework could look like. So we convened this panel of 23, you know, really national and international experts in acute care surgery, surgical oncology, vascular surgery, as well as anesthesia, palliative care, geriatrics, emergency medicine, healthcare innovation. And we really tried to include all the various subspecialists that would be stakeholders in these conversations to help inform what that conversation should look like in the context of, you know, a very busy, time-pressured emergency setting where, you know, oftentimes the surgeon doesn't have a relationship with the patient and their family. The patient and their family are often panicked. It's kind of like the perfect storm of how to have a difficult conversation, but they're often very necessary and set the tone for the type of treatment that the patient receives. You know, for better or for worse, it can be for weeks or even months. So that's how it came about.
So how do you deal with a patient? Let's stepping back from that time, what do you do? What recommendation do you give when the patient may be one thing, but the patient's family, when they're being unreasonable, when you feel like, hey, listen, they want to do more, and you know that's just, it's futile, but you're trying still to avoid that kind of medical, legal, are they going to sue you? They're pressing you. What do you say to young surgeons and even older surgeons that find themselves in that all too common situation?
I think, you know, one of the things that I've really learned from palliative care is recognizing that these, you know, decisions are often not rational. They're fraught with emotion. Patients and their families are scared, and they often need to be assured that they're really doing everything that's right for the patient. And so often we as clinicians fall into this trap of when a family says, I want everything done, frequently the family doesn't know what everything means. And that's how we end up in these scenarios where, you know, we do everything and then 48 hours later, they're like, this is not at all what I imagined. Nobody would have wanted this, you know, and then we find ourselves in a situation where we're withdrawing life-sustaining therapy. And I think a lot of surgeons have either been in that scenario or have seen it. And it's really devastating for everybody, right? Because nobody wants that. So that's the kind of scenario that we're hoping that we can avoid or at least mitigate. And I think a lot of it just has to do with asking people what they're afraid of, you know, and oftentimes what they're afraid of, and they're afraid that their loved one is going to suffer. And frequently surgery won't avoid that suffering. And in a lot of cases, we don't think it's going to prolong their life. In fact, we worry that it's going to prolong their death, but we don't give ourselves the opportunity to explain that because we get caught up in this trap of they want to do everything, so we feel obligated to do everything. And I feel like we can pause a little bit and probe more, ask them, you know, what they're worried about, what they're thinking of, what their expectation is for a good outcome. A lot of things that we discuss in the checklist, but I think that there are ways that we can kind of ask more pointed questions to figure out what the goal of the procedure is. And frequently, family members may have unrealistic expectations because they don't have a good understanding of what the patient's illness is. And it's an opportunity for us to educate and kind of correct course as opposed to following their lead, because it's often driven by misinformation and fear.
Now, Dr. Cooper, after reading through your article, it seems a lot of the core communication principles and all the things you guys talked about during your panel discussion are currently things that are going on now in current practice. Now, the question I have for you is, what specifically is different about your study and what your determinations were the best way to discuss with families in contrast to what is currently going on? Is it the organization, or is it the process, or is it the way the actual surgeon communicates with the family?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, because I think you're right. I think a lot of it is happening already. I think what's helpful is to provide a structure, and also to say, you know, these are the things that we should include in these conversations. But I think the other thing that's helpful is to outline, you know, what the best communication practices are. It may seem silly, but, you know, oftentimes we don't pause to sit down. We have a difficulty looking the patient and their family in the eye because we're afraid of the emotion in the room. And you have to be reminded to do those things. The other thing is, you know, the elements of the conversation are really focused on trying to elicit the patient's goals and values and what their priorities are for healthcare. And I think, again, it goes back to this assumption that we have, and I think it's so ingrained in us as surgeons, you know, that life is the holy grail and that prolonging life is really what everybody wants. But that's not always the case, and it's not true at any cost. And the challenge is that we're dealing with more and more patients and their families, patients who are living with chronic illness, who have, you know, life-limiting illness already. And they're not willing to make every trade-off, you know, to live a day longer in an ICU hooked up to a bunch of tubes. And so we have to ask. We just can't presume that that's what people want. And so the purpose of the framework is to really provide the foundation so that surgeons can get to that in an organized and structured way. You know, I think one of the things that I learned in palliative care that I think is so important is that, you know, the way that palliative care clinicians think about communication is as a procedure. In palliative care, communication is actually the procedure. And so it has steps, just like, you know, doing a surgical procedure. And you have to plan for it. You have to, you know, you go where it's easy, there are strategies, there are techniques, and then you think about how to close the conversation the same way you close the belly, for example. And so we're trying to help surgeons think of this as a procedure with steps and strategies to make it easier and simpler to do.
I have two questions. This is Kevin. One of them is, did you guys have experts in communication, like outside of, you know, surgeons probably generally aren't considered experts in communication in general. And did you include them in these discussions? And my other question is, do you have plans to help disseminate this information? I think this is a very helpful structure. And, you know, unfortunately, most residents, we're not posted up reading the top journals in our conference rooms every day. But I think this would be something very helpful to have in our ICUs and our surgical ICUs.
Right. So thank you for saying that. I think, yes, we did include experts in the communication. So two members in particular who were key members in our advisory panel, one was Susan Block, who is the senior author on the paper and leads the serious illness care program at Ariadne Labs. Is, you know, a world-renowned expert in communication, and she is a leader in palliative care, but she's also a psychiatrist. And then the other is James Kulski, who is now the director of palliative care at Brigham and Women's Hospital and the chief of palliative care and psychosocial oncology at Dana-Farber. He was at Duke at the time, and he and some of his colleagues have created something called Vital Talk, which is used in the oncology world. And it's used to train oncologists how to have difficult conversations and, of course, poor prognosis with patients. And it's been going on for years. So he was a key advisor in this. We relied heavily on those two in particular. But a number of the folks in the panel had expertise in communication. And we had Judy Nelson there, who is also an expert in communication and critical care. And then the second question was disseminating it. So, yes, we do have plans to disseminate it. And actually, one of the things that we're doing right now is trying to develop the simulation that we're hoping we can implement more widely. But we're doing some simulations with acute care surgeons and residents regionally right now to try to refine the simulation so that it's something that we can take nationally at a later date.
So in your experience, I was wondering if you had any, you know, kind of quick tips and tricks for residents or, you know, more junior level staff who are new to having these conversations. Oftentimes, these conversations are had in the emergency department under less than ideal situations where time is critical. So you have to, first you have to figure out what the prognosis for the patient and what to do yourself, you know, what you should be doing. And then you have to find a way of conveying this to a critically ill elderly patient who may or may not be demented or have delirium, and their family who may or may not really understand what's going on or know what their mom or dad wants to be done, and then make a decision. Are there any tactics or, you know, questions that you've found particularly helpful in talking to patients that you could share with us?
Yeah. So I think the first step is really to take a step back. You know, these are very time pressured situations, and they're so stressful for residents. I mean, part of the reason why I got into this and became interested in palliative care was because of my own moral distress about being in these scenarios. So I think, you know, the first thing is to acknowledge to yourself that these conversations are difficult, and they're rarely fun. I mean, they're not fun. And so, you know, you're not going to just kind of get through them quickly or easily necessarily. I think the other thing is to ask patients and families what they understand. I think oftentimes we presume that either they understand nothing or that they understand everything, and it's oftentimes something in the middle. And once you get a sense of what they understand about their illness, it's actually a good starting point to either, you know, either agree with them and say, yes, you know, I'm seeing what you're seeing, and so making sure that you're on the same page. So, for example, you know, what's your understanding of your mom's heart condition? And if they say, well, you know, it doesn't really cause her too many problems, but, you know, she's been in the hospital for, you know, every 3 weeks getting, you know, Lasix for congestive heart failure exacerbations, and she's been on a ventilator twice in the last 6 months. You say, well, you know, I get that at home she may be doing okay, but it does seem like she's having a hard time staying out of the hospital, and I'm worried that, you know, the fact that she's been in the hospital more and more tells us that her heart is really failing, and I worry about how she would do under general anesthesia with that. So if you kind of get a sense of where the patient and their family are, and then you then have an opportunity to interrupt, I mean, to interpret and to summarize that information for them. And that helps put it in context and make sure that you're all on the same page. I think the next thing is to acknowledge the emotion in the room. I think one thing that we often do is try to just pressure through these conversations. But in fact, they're difficult. And oftentimes it helps us also to make that human connection and say, you know, I'm sorry that this is happening, and this is really hard, and this has seemed so sudden for you. And just give patients and their families time to process what's happening. No matter how time pressured the scenario is, it often takes just a few minutes, and it can really change the focus of the conversation by giving them a minute to just say, yeah, you know, I get that this might be different, or, you know, the fact that grandma has a perforation now means that, you know, she may not be coming home again, that kind of thing. And then I do think that oftentimes, you know, it's probably not always appropriate for residents, but I do think for junior attendings in particular, we're often reluctant to make a recommendation. I think they're, you know, oftentimes we think about not wanting to overstep our bounds, or, you know, we want to respect patient autonomy. And while I do think that's important, you know, patients and families really look to us in these very high-pressure situations for our expertise, for our clinical judgment. I mean, they're not doctors. They don't always know. And so I think it is fair to say, you know, well, based on what I'm hearing, I don't think that surgery is going to achieve what we're hoping that it would. And I worry that, you know, your mom would be in an ICU for many months, or, you know, for many days or many weeks. And, you know, she's made it clear that she doesn't want to be on a ventilator, for example. And so, you know, even in scenarios where the decision is made to go ahead with surgery, and I need to be very clear that I think in the vast majority of these situations, even if you have these conversations, I think that oftentimes you're going to end up in the operating room, and that's fine. But then it also gives you an opportunity to have a time limit trial and say, well, you know, we'll go ahead and we'll do surgery, and, you know, we'll see where we are in 48 hours, and we'll recalibrate and see, you know, how they're doing. And it gives you time to have pause points throughout the patient's hospitalization, to make sure that what you're doing is in accordance with what their goals and priorities are at every step of the way. And frequently we kind of get into the scenario where we do everything up front and say, well, you know, the family wanted everything done. And then 2 months later, we're still saying, well, the family wanted everything done without ever having, you know, kind of checked in with them to make sure that we're still all on the same page. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so a couple of things. Unfortunately, in surgery, sometimes we find ourselves in these end-of-life situations from something that we did. You take a patient, and they have a leak, and now they're sepsis. And is that scenario different? Is it okay during, you know, that's an emotional moment, especially when they are not getting better, they are going down the tubes. Is it okay to reach out to the family and say, listen, I'm sorry. How do we avoid culpability for something that may have gone wrong that may be interpreted by them as a, you know, something that might turn into medical legal type stuff? And then it also kind of along those same lines is, how do you teach residents or how do you teach anybody really to show that type of emotion? Or what do you tell them when the family turns and says to you, you know, can I get a hug or can we pray or something like that? And you feel like you're a little bit out of your comfort zone.
Right. I think that's a great question. I actually hugged a patient in the emergency room the other night. And like, I've never been hugged by a doctor before. And I said, well, you look like you needed it. So, you know, I'm just a person. And you look like you needed a hug. So I would say that, you know, as far as being worried about medical legal stuff, I mean, obviously that's present and that's real, but the literature bears out that the lawsuits come from poor communication. And it doesn't necessarily come from bad medicine. It often comes from poor communication and misunderstanding. And I think that, you know, it's okay to say, I'm sorry that this happened, you know, or I wish things had turned out differently. You know, and if there is an anastomotic leak or something, then that's a known complication of the procedure. And so it's possible. And I think when you're explaining, or at least when I'm explaining risks and benefits to patients, I'll say, look, you know, there's a 0.5% chance of a common bile duct injury, for example, but if it happens to you, you're in the 100%. So I need you to know that this is a real possibility. And so, you know, oftentimes in the informed consent process, it's hard to remember all of that. But I do think that you can go back and say, you know, this is unfortunately an expected complication of the procedure, but you know, I sure wish that this hadn't happened, and you need to know that we did our very best to avoid it, but sometimes these things do happen, and I feel terrible. I wish it had been different. You know, and even if it's something that's not your fault, I think oftentimes we're reluctant to make that connection because we're worried about being blamed for it. But, you know, just by saying, I'm sorry this happened, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're accepting responsibility for it happening. But the medical legal literature will bear out that you know, at least making that connection often avoids lawsuits instead of creating them. As far as, you know, being emotionally open to patients and families, I think you really have to be yourself. And I don't think that anybody who's uncomfortable, you know, having that kind of physical contact or emotional contact with a patient or family should feel that they're forced to. But at the same time, I feel like many of us do feel comfortable or would want to do that and feel uncomfortable doing so. And I really do think that it leads to burnout, like this lack of personal connection that we have with our patients, this wall that we put up between them and ourselves really leads to burnout. And I would encourage people who are feeling like they want to make that connection to do so. Do I think that, you know, it's appropriate that if you're at a family meeting in the ICU for the physician to burst out into tears? Absolutely not. I don't think, because I think it should be about the patient and the family. And it shouldn't be about the clinician. That being said, you know, to say this is so sad and I'm so sad that this is happening, I think it's perfectly normal and natural. You know, an 18-year-old who has a terrible traumatic brain injury, I mean, that's devastating. And so it shouldn't be okay. And I think as far as religion, I think that's a really, really important question. And I feel like, you know, you can't do things that make you uncomfortable. And I've often been asked to pray with patients and families, and you know, I've been very honest with them when I don't feel comfortable. I'm saying, you know, I want to support you in that, and I will support you if I can. Let me sit here with you. But that doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to pray. So I won't argue with them about it, but I'll just say, I'll sit here with you. But thank you for inviting me to share this with you. Those are the kinds of things that I have found helpful.
Yeah. I really want to highlight to the medical students and maybe interns out there listening. You know, I think if I would have heard this topic, I would have thought, you know, this wouldn't really involve me as a junior resident. I don't have to worry about this till I'm a staff. And I really think this is a very important point of training that we're missing out on because, you know, coming through residency, you know, many times the staff will have these conversations with the patients, but many times you're the first person there, whether it's in the ER, whether it's in the ICU in the middle of the night and the patient gets sick. So it's really important for the younger residents and med students out there to spend some time reading through this and learning how to communicate with your patients, because whether you know it or not, you will be in these situations.
Right. I agree.
And so now I think we're going to move on to our tips and tricks. And Dr. Cooper, we thought we would have you take us through one of the more challenging situations that comes in. It's the malignant bowel obstruction or the carcinomatosis. How do you approach these patients? What options do you have? When do you bypass? When do you just place a G-tube? When do you bail? How do you approach these patients?
Yeah, so I think the first thing, again, always my first step is to really ask them what they understand. I mean, you know, if you look at the data on malignant bowel obstruction, you know, it's typically the end stages of cancer. And so, you know, the median life expectancy for these patients is about 3 months. And so frequently, you know, and this is whether they have surgery or they have, you know, a venting G-tube or they don't, they have medical management. So I think that understanding that ourselves is really important. And then understanding where the patient and the family think they are in their trajectory. And then, you know, talking to the oncologist or whoever is, you know, primarily managing them to make sure that everybody's on the same page. And frequently, you know, outside of a perforation or ischemia, you know, these are conversations that happen over days. And so I think we can take the time to have real conversations. The other thing is that I do, you know, a lot of malignant bowel obstructions can be managed medically. They can be managed with steroids. They can be managed with, you know, anti-secretory agents like octreotide. And so I think surgeons don't know enough about the medical management of malignant bowel obstruction, but there's an excellent text, American College of Surgeons, A Resident's Guide to Palliative Care, that outlines it beautifully. And I think that surgeons have to become more familiar with the medical management of malignant bowel obstruction because it can help a lot of people. As far as when to bypass and when not to bypass, you know, CT scans are notoriously you know, inaccurate. You can see the carcinomatosis, but you can't necessarily see all of the areas of obstruction. And, you know, oftentimes if you think that there's just one discrete area, or many of these patients have had abdominal surgery in the past and there's a chance that it's adhesive disease, I think if their ECOG score is low, which is a marker of their physical fitness, and if it looks like they are potentially going to have chemotherapy again, and this obstruction is stopping them from having chemotherapy, I think it is worth considering doing a bypass. But you have to, you know, be very upfront with the patient and their family that you don't know that it's going to work, what the risks are, and that, you know, in patients who have carcinomatosis, fistula is a big problem. So, you know, you have to kind of outline all of that. And I think one of the things that we think about a lot are risks and benefits, but I really talk to patients and families about burdens of treatment, because, you know, they're going to have to live with the wound complications or the fistula or whatever it may be. And then I'm also... although diffuse carcinomatosis is often a difficult scenario for a venting PEG because of the risks of gastrostomy tubes in that setting, you know, particularly patients with ascites, et cetera, you know, I wouldn't do a PEG in a patient who has a lot of ascites, you know, but venting PEGs can be a real lifesaver in the sense that they can get patients home earlier, they can get patients to hospice earlier, and then as far as kind of overall trajectory, I mean, most of these patients are patients that are eligible for hospice. And I think that that's something that should be considered and introduced.
Well, thank you, Dr. Cooper, for those great tips and tricks. But I want to swing back and just to the end of our dissection of the day and talk about the, you know, your paper and in the next steps and implementation. Now, how do you get this out to those people in the surgical critical care arena? And is this going to be like training, or are you going to have, you know, workshops for this?
Yeah, so what we're doing right now is in these simulations that we're creating, we're trying to develop the simulation, as I said, and I'm hoping that we'll get, you know, the data that we need so that we can get grant funding to do this at this point. Because I think we do need to have training. I think this is part of an educational program. It really is part of an educational program, and I think it's a very different way of approaching these scenarios than certainly what I was taught in surgery. And so I think that in order to have these conversations, surgeons have to, have a better understanding of kind of the chronic illnesses that we're dealing with and a better understanding of the trajectories of cancer and heart failure and COPD, because we're going to see them more and more. And there are actually defined trajectories for these illnesses. So I think surgeons need to become more familiar with that. I think the other thing is that surgeons need to become more comfortable with palliative care. I mean, there aren't enough palliative care clinicians to provide all the palliative care that's needed out there. We need to have a better understanding of it. Palliative care and hospice are really not the same thing. Hospice is an administrative model for delivering palliative care for patients who have a life expectancy of 6 months or less. Palliative care is a way to approach care to really maximize the patient's quality of life while they're living as long as possible for patients who have serious and chronic illness. And many, many of the patients that we encounter, not just as acute care surgeons, but as, for example, vascular surgeons, would fit this bill. And that's going to become increasingly true as the population ages. So I think surgeons need to become better palliative care providers, and that includes communication, advanced directives, family support, psychosocial support, spiritual support, and then most importantly, symptom management. I think malignant bowel obstruction is really a model for this because it's really all about symptom management. And so one of the things that we need to do when we talk to patients about their goals and values for treatment is really understanding what symptoms they're hoping to address. And then I think as far as, you know, getting this out there, again, you know, we're hoping to get some grant funding. And actually, we did a workshop at the American College of Surgeons meeting last October. Brian Badgewell from MD Anderson and I did a palliative care skills CME course. That was great. And we're hoping to repeat that in future college sessions. And then I'm also hoping that we can get some traction at AAST and other professional organizations where this is relevant.
Outstanding. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Cooper. That was all great. Now, this is obviously a very, very heavy topic, a very serious topic, but a very important topic. And I thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us about it. And just to lighten things up a little bit, we end out every interview with what we call the final five, which is five simple, you know, quick shot, easy questions to help us get to know our guest a little bit better. So number one on the final five is, do you listen to music in the operating room? And if so, what's on your playlist?
So I do listen to music in the operating room. I don't have a playlist because I want the entire team to be happy. If I had a playlist, it'd all be Rolling Stones, which makes me feel very old, even though I'm not that old. My only rule is that it can't be any heavy metal, but everything else is okay. So we end up with a good variety of stuff.
Number two, tell us about an interest, hobby, or talent you have outside of the operating room.
I have a young daughter, so that's where most of my time goes outside of the operating room. We're pretty avid skiers, which helps us get through the New England winters. So my family is really big into skiing, and we found it a huge lifesaver.
Question number three, is there a favorite trip or vacation that you've taken recently that you want to tell us about?
Let's see, a favorite trip. Well, we had a family reunion in Florida over school vacation, which was really nice. But we have a place out in Western Mass that is like on a lake, and it's really quiet, and that's our favorite place to be. So we go out there with friends and family a lot. And I highly recommend for any surgeons who can find a little place in the world of solitude. It really is a great way to recharge.
Number four, if you could go back in time and go into a field outside of medicine, what field would you choose?
Oh, wow, that's so hard. That's really hard, actually. I really do love surgery. I think when I started off in college, I wanted to be a journalist. And, I decided that I didn't really want to be a journalist. I wanted to be an opinion writer, and I'd still love to be an opinion writer. Yeah, I'd be pretty happy if I could get my own op-ed column in the New York Times or the Washington Post. But I think that's probably a different lifetime.
Okay, last one, number five. If you could talk to yourself on your first day of your surgical internship, what one piece of advice would you give yourself, knowing what you know now?
You know, I think knowing what I know now, being an attending is really a lot better than being a resident. And I think if I had known how much better it was, it would have made my residency shorter. I loved being a resident. I loved my residency. I had a great time. But kind of the lack of control that I had over my schedule was grueling. And I think that's grueling for a lot of people. I started off my residency in, before work hours. So I didn't see the light of day for many, many weeks. And kind of just knowing that the autonomy comes and just what a great career this is, I think would have made it easier.
Well, Zara, thank you so much for joining us on Behind the Knife. And we truly appreciate you sharing with us a topic that we don't get an opportunity to talk about much and have the opportunity to learn from experts in the field like yourself. We wish you the best regarding the grant funding, and we really look forward to the opportunity to have this implemented across the nation for everybody in at any stage of medicine. So thank you so much for sharing this here on BTK.
And thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
And that's it for us today. Thanks for joining us on Behind the Knife. We'll see you next week.
Until next time, dominate the day.